Welcome back to Shaifus. I'm going to load up two things on the WhatsApp today. One, I did yesterday while by the airport, I did a review of all the Dapim. And once you know it well, it took me, I just said over the Dapim, it took 18 minutes. You can do Beis, Gimel, Dalet, and three Dapim in 18 minutes. So you wonder how people do a lot of Dapim per day. Once you know it well, you just do the Chazara, it's easy. It moves. It has not, it just goes quickly and you're able to review and cover the Dapim. So then they have 36 minutes. But you understand now why people can go through more Dapim per day. It's just if you do the Chazara, the Dapim become, you understand. And many of the sukkahs repeat themselves throughout Shas. You don't realize how many times the mitzvah zaseh shazman grama nashim. You know how many times that comes up throughout Shas? Sukkahs are repeated as well. We already saw a repeat of chetziyah v'chetziyah min chorin like three times in three Dapim. So you build the cadence and then it's easy to review that way.
The matzah dab,
right.
18 minutes.
No, we did three matzah dab. Okay. So what I want to do today is another way to drive home the information is to talk a little bit deeper about some of the subjects we've covered. And we've covered a whole bunch of subjects. So number one, the Brice on Gimel Amid Beis talked about three signs that show that a person is a shota. One, he goes out alone at night. Two, he sleeps in a graveyard. And three, he tears his clothes like crazy. So Rav Huna and Rav Yochanan disagree about how many of those signs a person has to show to be called a shota. Rav Huna says that one is not a shota until he does all three. Rav Yochanan says that a person has a status of a shota even by one. And the Gemara concludes that even one can make a person a shota. The Gemara's conclusion is based on another brisa we saw that says that a definite sign that one is a shota when a person loses everything you give them. And the Gemara asks that whether that brisa proves that any single strange action is enough. Right, you don't need three, or any single strange action which is similar to losing something is what you need. What kind of strange action do you need? And the Gemara left it as a teiku. Now, why does the Gemara suggest the possibility that tearing one's clothing alone is enough to prove that a person has a shota, while the other two signs have to be combined in order to show that a person is a shota? The first brisa clearly said that one is considered a shota when he does these three. So if tearing one's clothing alone renders them a shota, why does the brisa say that he has to do all three? Once he tore the clothing, he's a shota, regardless of whether or not, if he does the other two. And if he only slept in a graveyard and walked outside at night alone but hasn't ripped his clothing, he hasn't shown that he's a shota. So why does the brisa even mention the other two signs? What's the point of the other two signs in any way by the time you get to the end of the Gemara? So the brisa must mean that if a person does either one of these three actions by themselves, they must be a shota, like the first option of the Gemara. The second option of the Gemara makes no sense, right? The second option of the Gemara was, so since we said that that one criteria is enough, that a person loses everything you give them, does that mean that a person who rips their clothing, right, that a person who rips their clothing, that is enough as well because that's similar? Or no, that's not enough? Like, why would the first brisa put all three together? Why does the act of tearing one's clothing make a person into a shota, while the other two have to be done in combination with other acts? The brisa seems to put them on the same level. This is not my kasha. This is the kasha of the Turei Evan. He asked this question, and he answers as follows. He says the following. Tosfos Gimel Amud Beis says that according to Rav Huna, Rav Huna is the one who says you're a shota only when you do all three. Even if you do one of these three strange acts three times, you're still not a shota. You have to do each one at least once in order to be a shota. So if that's the opinion of Rav Huna, why does Rav Yochanan disagree? Right? Does he hold that doing even one act one time is enough? Or does he disagree and hold you need one act three times? What does he hold? So the Turei Evan holds that Rav Yochanan is of the position that only when you do a single act three times are you a shota. You don't become a shota by doing one act three times. So when the brisa says that one has to do three acts to be a shota, it means even though you're tearing your clothing, you're not a shota until you do two other acts. Because the way that tearing makes a person a shota is when he does that three times. So that's the way to understand the brisa. The brisa that says you need to do three things, what? It doesn't give one. So meaning that the idea that you need to do three, according to Rabbi Yochanan, it means you need to do any of the three, three times. Any of the three, three times. That's his position. The Chidushim Ubiurim holds that Rav Huna needs that the person do all three acts in order for a person to be a shota. Only when he does each act in a way that doesn't necessarily prove he's a shota, there's another explanation. But when he does an act in a way that it's absolutely clear that he did it because he's a shota for no other reason, he's considered a shota even if he does only one of the three. So then what's the Gemara's conclusion? The Gemara's conclusion is that the Braisa means that tearing one's clothing alone is enough to classify you as a shota. And each of the other two acts in the Braisa will also make you a shota when it's done, when there's no other alternative explanation. So meaning all three acts are equal. What stood out about who loses everything you give him? There's no usually credible explanation of why he keeps losing everything. Once, twice, you could say absent-minded. But kol masha nosdim lo, everything you give him implies multiple times.
So you only need one of the three?
Well, it depends. Chedusha Be'orim's understanding of the sugya says you just need one of the three, according to that opinion, and in a way that clearly there's no other explanation.
Forget.
Husband and a wife, yeah.
Yeah.
A husband who's a shota can't give it, a woman who's a shota can't receive it.
Right, exactly. No status, but he'd be allowed to remarry. That's why it's not such a big topic. Okay. Now, number two, this Gemara says that Eved should be exempt from Re'iyah because of Exeret Shava. La, which compares a slave to a woman. And just as a woman is exempt from mitzvah seishas mangrama, a slave is exempt also from these mitzvahs. But here's the problem. The pasuk in Vayikra, of which the Gzeres Shava is learned, is discussing a shivcha, a maidservant, whose freedom was not yet given to her. La. How can the Gemara learn from a comparison between a woman and a shivcha that a male slave is exempt from mitzvahs? The Gzeres Shava teaches only that a female slave is exempt from mitzvahs like a woman. La, la. A male slave could be different than a female slave, just as a Jewish man differs from a Jewish woman with regards to mitzvah observance. Why do we assume, because the topic's talking about shivcha, it's also referring to a male slave? So you can't say that even without the Gzeres Shava, we would have known that a maidservant's chi of a mitzvah is like a woman, since she's also a woman, and therefore la should be used to be a man. Why is that no good? Because the Gemara in Kedushin, Chaf Gimel Amid Aleph, learns from Gzeres Shava many of the laws of writing a slave's get of freedom from the laws of writing a woman's get. So you see, even if the Gzeres Shava is not needed to teach that a mitzvah chiyuv of a shivcha, there's no indication that it should be used to teach the mitzvah chiyuv of a male slave, because we already used it to teach something else. So again, this is a question now, this is a question Rabbi Kiva Eiger, Turei Evan. So the Turei Evan, the Achronim discussed the nature of the chiyuv of a slave in mitzvahs, and what exactly the Gzeres Shava of law teaches. Would you have assumed that a slave is obligated in all mitzvahs like an ordinary Jew, and the Gzeres Shava limits his chiyuv to that of a woman? Or alternatively, what was the baseline assumption? Maybe that a slave is completely free, right? What's the baseline assumption? That a slave is completely chayiv and law limits? Or is the baseline assumption that a slave is completely free of mitzvahs and law increases? Which way does it go? So the Turei Evan Rabbi Kiva Eiger suggests that a slave would have been exempt from mitzvahs completely, and the Gzeres Shava upgrades him to be chayiv like a woman. Therefore, there's no makor to obligate a male slave in any mitzvahs other than those of a woman. He has no other makor. He's starting at zero. So therefore, that takes him up to the woman. Without the pasuk, he's like a non-Jew. And the pasuk obligates him only in the mitzvahs of a woman. There's no makor other than this Gzeres Shava to obligate him in more mitzvahs. Okay, Tosus seems to say this in Baba Kama as well, Peches Amid Aleph. It says the Gzeres Shava serves to mechayev him mitzvahs and not to limit. You understand? When we have a Gzeres Shava of law that compares him to a woman in mitzvahs, is the law reducing his obligation or increasing his obligation? So Turei Evan and Rabbi Kiva Eiger suggest that he would have been obligated in zero, so it's increasing his obligation. And this understanding actually is meduyak in the words of the Gemara. The Gemara says any mitzvah which a woman is obligated to do, a slave is obligated to. And any mitzvah which she's not obligated to do, a slave is not obligated to. The Gemara doesn't say any mitzvah from which a woman is potter, the slave is also potter. Rather, by phrasing it in terms of a chiyuv, obligations, and not ptur, you see he was not made chayuv to begin with. He starts with no chiyuv, and therefore increases obligations. Rabbi Kiva Eiger questioned this mahalach. Why? Because the Rambam paskins that the Torah's isser against shaving one's beard applies to a slave, even though the isser does not apply to a woman. whose physical nature is such that she doesn't really grow facial hair. So why should this prohibition apply to a slave if it doesn't apply to a woman? So it seems, says Rabbi Akiva Eiger, that the baseline chiyuv of a slave is that he is obligated in all the mitzvahs. The gzeirah shava reduces him down to that which a woman is obligated in. And a slave remains obligated by the isser against shaving, because the only reason why a woman is exempt from this is because of her physical nature, which the eved does not share. It's a technicality. Okay, if a slave would have been exempt from all the mitzvahs without the gzeirah shava, and the gzeirah shava gives him the chiyuv of a woman, he shouldn't be obligated to observe the isser against shaving. So that's a good kasha. The Rambam is a good kasha against the shita of the Turei Evan, who seems to say the baseline is that the Evan has no chiyuv of him. It's a great kasha. So Rav Elchanan and Wasserman in Kovetz Ha'aretz.
First of all,
yeah.
These are all negative commandments.
Okay.
It would apply if she did have it.
So Rav Elchanan Wasserman says it's not a valid question. You know why? Like you're saying, Mr. Gnauer. A woman's exempt only because of her physical nature. It's as if the Torah did command her to observe the mitzvah, but her physical nature exempts her from it. Therefore, since in theory she is obligated, a slave is also going to be obligated. Since his physical nature is such that it does grow a beard, he's not going to be exempt like a woman. So that little twist in how to view it changes everything. Rav Gustman Zitzal pointed out that this mahalach is actually the subject of a machlokas rishonim. So the halacha says that a slave has to go into a mikvah twice, once when he becomes a slave and once when he's free. And the Rambam writes in Hilchas Yisurei Bia that it's only after the second tevila in the mikvah that his conversion is complete and he becomes a full-fledged Jew. That implies before the second tevila, the slave is not considered a full-fledged Jew, like the approach of Rabbi Akiva Eiger. That also might be the intention of Rashi's.
So listen to this.
So by a Isurei Bia, by an Eved, right? In Eved, the Rambam says that his conversion, he only becomes a full-fledged Jew by the second tefillah, okay? Rashi in Yavama says that a slave dips first time to become a slave. At that moment, he becomes Shayach B'mitzvahs. Rashi only calls him only Shayach B'mitzvahs, related to mitzvahs, okay? Why doesn't Rashi write chayev b'mitzvahs? So it seems that Rashi understands that a slave is not chayev in mitzvahs, but only shayech in mitzvahs, which means that the mitzvahs apply to him, but not in the same way that they apply to a normal Jew. There's only a shayches b'mitzvahs. That's the point I want to make. Forget the conversion part. That part. Rashi calls by a slave, he's shayech b'mitzvahs. The Nemukei Yosef Yomas quotes the Ramban, who says the second tefillah of the slave is only midurabanan requirement. The first tefillah made him a full-fledged Jew, mid-da'araisa. So you have this in other areas. The Rishonim disagree about whether the body of a dead slave is usur bahana. Is it usur to get benefit, like the body of a Jew? Or whether it's mutter bahana, like the body of a Nachri? Tosas and Sota says that a living slave does not become tame, just as a Nachri doesn't become tame. Rabbi Akiva Eiger wonders why a slave doesn't become tummy. If the Gzeirah Shava compares him to a woman, just as a woman could become tummy, a slave should become tummy. Slimly, the corpse of a slave should be asur bana, just like the body of a woman. So the answer, Tosfos and Zvachim says, the Gzeirah Shava, which compares a slave to a woman, applies only as far as the mitzvah is concerned. The Gzeirah Shava teaches nothing about the halachic nature of the slave. And therefore, since the slave, yes, in Eved Kenani, is essentially a Nachri, he cannot become Tameh, and his corpse is Mutter Bahana. That's based on the approach of Rabbi Akiva Eiger above, that a slave would not be obligated. The baseline is no mitzvahs. The Rishonim would disagree and say this. Wait, let's see the other side. The Rishonim would disagree and say that a slave becomes Tameh and his corpse is Asur Bahana. Hold the Gzeirah Shava applies to the halachic nature just as it applies to the Chiyuv and Mitzvahs. Meaning they follow the Ramban, that he follows that a slave at his first Tvila has the status of a Jew. So here we're talking about, in this conversation, for the Machlokas.
So if he enters it and he leaves, why when he leaves he has to go to the Mikvah?
Because he lived the entire experience as a Jew. He lived in a Jewish home. He spent the entire experience in a Jewish home, and that's what they want him to. They want him to upgrade and to be to that he lived his life that way.
What?
Is
it a risk at all or not?
Do you do Atafas Dam Brit? Okay, so one more topic before we finish. The Gemara describes how a number of Amorayim would cry when they would read certain psukim we saw. And apparently, the psukim that so deeply affected each Amora seemed to have some connection to why they cried. So we said Rabbi Yochanan cried when he read certain particular psukim. When he read the pasuk which described how Hashem is persuaded by the Satan to punish somebody for no reason. Yesh nispa belo mishpat. He cried. Right? So, why? Why did he cry this? You see Rabbi Yochanan also... you're going to see some more psukim like this that we're going to get to in the next Gemaras, where Rabbi Yochanan has more psukim, which Hashem punishes a person for sinning by accident, where Hashem's going to punish people with afflictions that can't be fixed. It's a very similar theme the whole way through. So I heard someone suggest that maybe Rabbi Yochanan was sensitive to these experiences because of what he went through. The Gemara in Brachas, Hayamid Beis, talks about Rabbi Yochanan lost 10 sons, and he didn't despair. And he accepted the tragedies as Yisurin Shel Ahava. So the pasuk in Eov, which says, Vasiteni bo levalo chinam, that sometimes Hashem afflicts a person for no reason, that's when the person has no sins. The afflictions are Yisurin Shel Ahava, which like the Gemara in Brachas talks about. So maybe that's why these psukim, which talked about crying for him, those are how it relates to him. You could say similarly also the other Amoraim who were crying by their psukim. Rav Huna cried when he described how Hashem once yearned to see the Jewish people come to Yerushalayim, and now he says, who asked you to trample in my courtyard? Right? We saw that pasuk. Who asked you to, Ramos Chatzerai, who asked you to trample my courtyard? He once yearned for people to have korbanos to the shlamim. And he said, who was asking you to bring it? Why? Because you have the Gemara in Brachos, Hamad Beis, when Gemara says that 400 barrels of Rav Huna's wine went sour, and the Rabbanon came to comfort him. And Rav Huna was very wealthy, and he used his money for mitzvahs and tzedakah, Moed Katan Kavches. And when his entire inventory went bad, he watched as Hashem not only took away his business, but impoverished him. And he exclaimed that until that time, he used his wealth to provide for Talmidei Chachamim. And providing for Talmidei Chachamim is similar to Korbanos. We know that from Brachos 10b. However, Hashem has taken everything away from him as if he does not want Rav Huna to even serve him anymore. Rabbi Elazar cried when he read about the exactness of Hashem's justice, right? With Shmuel being afraid he was going to be judged again. And Yosef's brothers being afraid when they heard what's coming their way. So the Gemara in Tanis Chafei says that Rabbi Elazar suffered from extreme poverty, and he accepted Hashem's judgment and declared that Hashem's treatment of him was just, and no one could judge Hashem's decisions. So you see, what they're crying about fit exactly what happened in their lives. One more. Rav Yosef cried when he reached the pasuk, Yesh nispe below mishpat. There are those, sometimes a person's life is cut short prematurely, and his remaining years are given away to a Talmid Chacham who is humble. So the Gemara Nedarim 41a says that Rav Yosef became blind and forgot all his learning. He became sick. And that may have occurred 22 years before his death. At the time when the Gemara tells us, interesting Gemara in 64, that there were those who were predicting his death. And the Gemara in Brachos says that it was time to appoint a new Rosh Yeshiva. Rav Yosef deferred to Rabbah and gave him the position. And that act qualified him as a Talmud Chacham, who acts with a nevus and does not stand up for his rights. Rav Yosef understood that the reason he recovered from his illness and lived for another 22 years was because Hashem had given him the years of someone who died prematurely in reward for his anivus. So that's why this pasuk was a trigger for Rav Yosef and why he was crying about it. Yesh nispa below mishpat, that the years are given to someone else, a Talmud Chacham who's humble, because he knew what happened in his own life, that God had given him those extra years. We'll stop there for today.